Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. The NAMM Foundation is working to assure that all children have the opportunity to learn and grow with music, and that music is part of daily living for everyone. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, everyone. This is Mary Lurson back with you at Talking Up Music Education here at Nashville from Summer NAMM with our partners at EnterTalk Radio. Please join us here for this Facebook Live that's also available via NAMM Foundation. It's been a bit of a long day at the Summer NAMM show, so forgive me, I'm bumbling a little bit to start. And I'm also a little bit awestruck because I'm here with the iconic a cappella jazz ensemble, not a cappella all the time, but jazz ensemble, jazz vocal ensemble, the Manhattan Transfer. Yes, they're really in the house.
Hello, Mary.
Hi. Three quarters of us, anyway.
Yes, three quarters. We're missing one of the members, Cheryl Benteen, Paul Allen Paul, almost said Paul Allen, and Janice Siegel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Am I right? Alto?
Nope, soprano.
Alto here.
Alto.
Tenor. And our bass is missing.
Tris Curlis, yes.
So welcome to Summer NAMM, and you are here to receive the National Music Council's American Eagle Award. So we're so honored that you are here with
us. Thank you.
Well, we're very honored.
So talking about music education, our little podcast that can't stop talking about music education, we always start our conversations with our guests about what I like to call your musical origins, your origin story, right? Mm. And going way back to where music, when you identified as a human being, that music was just right there for you and something was really passionate and important. Teachers, home, family, we just would love to hear it. Because what we care about here is that music education is something available to every child. And we know sometimes a story, especially from how many Grammys? Ten.
Mm-hmm.
Ten. One year there was two in 1 year.
Right? Mm-hmm. That was a good year.
It was a very good year. Someone should use that in a song, right?
Yes.
But, you know, that it means so much when we know that a life that has achieved this in music also started maybe in the same place that every child can start if they have music. So who would like to start with
CB, why don't you start?
Well, I don't talk about this very often, and it's really, like you said, it is the root of who I am as a singer, as a musician, as a person. My father was a Dixieland jazz clarinet player. So at a very early age, you know, that music was in the house. They were rehearsing all the time, and it just kind of osmosis-wise just went into my bones. I mean, I think I came in, you know, snapping on two and four. Yeah. I always say that. I came into the world. And so I sang when I was about 14, I started singing with him. But school-wise, you know, I came from a very small town, Mount Vernon, Washington, which really didn't have any outside, you know, music programs at all. They had a choir. They had musicals. I did the musicals. I didn't do the choirs, interestingly enough. So when I met my partners, it was the first time I'd sung with other voices. But I had a piano teacher when I was in first grade, and like the first 6 years of my of school, Mrs. King, and she was like 80. You know, and I went to her every week, and I don't ever mention her, but she, of course, that's a big part of who I am. You know, I took piano lessons.
You learned the basics? You learned the elements? You could read? Right?
Yes, I can read, and it was routine, and it was something that was just a part of me that I did over and over and over. So even when it isn't in the schools, you know, I took private lessons. My mother, I was lucky enough that my mother just pulled me out of school every Friday and drove me to the next town, and I took piano lessons.
So family has a big influence, the availability.
Very big.
And I think doing these musical performances should not be under, I remember in high school I did them.
Yeah,
It was a big, big, big show.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You know, you might as well be on Broadway the way you felt doing
that's right.
Them, right?
I felt like I was.
<You're> right. And how about you, Al? I'll go right down the line. You're musical origins.
It's kind of a long story. My grandfather was a cantor. And my mother was also a singer, so there was always music in my house. And when I started singing when I was about six, when I was nine, I started taking lessons in New York with a man named Charlie Lowe, who had a school for kids. A lot of the professional kids that were in the city, they, you know, you would study dance and you would study personality with him. He was an old vaudevillian. When I was with him, he must have been almost close to 80. His wife Kasha taught tap dance, and he came from vaudeville. And so all the music that we learned, that we did, was all vaudevillian. I didn't know anything about that at the time. I didn't realize what the significance of
that. So you really
that.
Grew out of it. That was a rich New York tradition, too, right? These professional children's schools, and you know, the fact that you could go in and have this, you know, basically, get ready, kid, you're going on stage, you know? It's really
and
great.
He would, we would tour. We would do, in the summertime, we would go up to an area called the Catskill Mountains. And he would take 14 of us kids, and we would do a review. We would do the palace, you know, and each one of us kids, we would sing a song from Al Jolson, Eva Tangwe, Russ Colombo, mm-hmm. Eddie Cantor, all these different stars that were from that time. But I think the goal was always to get into the business. And then when I was 12, I got into
he was 12.
Yeah, right.
I was in the original Broadway cast of Oliver.
Oh, wow.
And then I did a bunch of other shows, and I was a young actor in New York. And absolutely, without a question, you know, I think the biggest influence for me was the Boys Club from Newark. Because I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and they were, I think, my biggest supporters. They gave me a scholarship for music so that I could study, because my family really didn't have the money, and supported me all the way through college.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's wonderful.
So,
it's just wonderful.
Family, community, mm-hmm. school.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, the fact that you are surrounded by nurturing people.
Absolutely.
You know, there's another name for the Catskills, too.
And we Borscht.
The Borscht Bells.
I live in Westchester County, so, right? Right. I mean, there's another, you know, back in the heyday, where in the summer, it was where all the artists were and all the headliners were and all the singers and the comedians and
the strippers.
It was amazing training ground for me as a performer. But just talking in general, I know we're going to skip and you want to get to jazz, but just in terms of music, as you get the importance of music, the fight is that a lot of educators, a lot of people don't understand the importance of music, of how important it is to the development of a child, you know, and their life. But we'll get to that later, I'm sure.
Well, and yes, and you know, that fight is the fight. It's been the fight of my life, and also the fight of this great organization. You know, to really, we want every child to have the opportunity. Now,
absolutely.
What they do with the opportunity will be mm-hmm. very varied, and it will go from, you know, hopefully the next generation to accomplish the same, have the passion to accomplish the same thing that your wonderful ensemble has brought to the world. Mm-hmm. There will be more, right? But also whatever they bring to the table in their own life is what matters, what their choices are. All right, Janice, you've had time to think about this.
Yeah, I have. Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my earliest memory of singing was with my father in the car. He would croon, he would sing like Bing Crosby, and I would sing harmony with him, not knowing what it was, really, just something natural. But really, the turning point, again, was family. My aunt gave me a guitar, an acoustic guitar, which is why I looked so lovingly and longingly at the guitar, because I don't play it anymore. It was an extra raffle present she had or something from an affair she was running. So she just gave me the guitar out of the blue, and I went, oh my God, I'll teach myself to play this. And I did. And I found two other girlfriends, close girlfriends, that were similarly inclined, and we started a group. And we were 12 years old, and we somehow got a manager from the local high school. We were still in eighth grade, at this point. And he took us to a producer named Richard Perry in the city, big city. Dynamite Productions had just opened up. And Richard Perry, who went on to produce legendary acts, including the Manhattan Transfer, he was just starting out in the business then. And we got a record deal. We recorded singles, you know, and
back in the wonderful little 45 days, right?
I mean, live with the orchestra. So my first experience really was recording. And we performed all through high school, and we played guitar and sang folk music and original music. In school, there was really no outlet for this kind of education, sadly, at that time. But there was Sing, and I was in Sing, which is, you know, the yearly theatrical show. I was in Sing every year, which I enjoyed. But I wasn't in choir, really, or any of that. I was too busy with my own music.
But you had an exceptional, I mean, really all of you, out of the gate, there was something. It's like it was a force.
Well, it was a force that was so strong, it was useless to resist.
I mean, to be
at
12, I had, you know, then I started the next phase of my career at 12. You were in ninth grade. The next phase of my career, I signed with.
I didn't look at it as a career, though.
Right.
At that juncture, I was really interested in other things like medicine or marine biology. I thought, my parents did not push music as a career, really. And
the gigs, though, they drove you.
And even jazz. I wasn't into jazz really till I got to college, and even then I was only listening to instrumental music. Mm-hmm. So now the depth and of the programs that exist for jazz vocalists is extraordinary throughout the university and high school world. You can take these courses that it took us years to learn by just trial and error, or someone helped you, or you did it yourself. You know, now it's all laid out for kids.
But
today,
you were also the trailblazers. I mean, of a sound. Right? I mean, you were as an ensemble. I mean, I think you must hear that over and over and over, the sounds.
Well, we were based on what came before us.
Yeah.
Too. We were historians, really, scholars of vocal groups, and we studied what groups existed and their voicings and how they, their material, and then we built on that.
So it was a very studied progression.
Well, it was definitely a point of view to do four-part harmony, closed harmony, and to make records. And that really, you know, in pop music at the time, four-part harmony was considered jazz. Any that fourth part was like the jazz chord. And for pop music, if that existed, they'd throw the record out. They would not play it. It had to be just a triad, you know.
Straight.
Too sophisticated.
It's like what the French Impressionists did, the start of that, when Ravel and Debussy added the sixth and the ninth to classical music.
Right.
It became jazzy.
Mm-hmm. So let's jump into this magical, from us who didn't live the last 40 years with you, it feels magical, but we know it was hard work and a lot of twists and turns and the realities of moving into the different conditions in the marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. And the different forms of delivery, right? From going from record labels to contracts to, I mean, you've seen a lot. You've experienced a lot. I always have to ask, how did you take care of these precious things that you have? How did you take care of the pipes?
Well, a lot of years of just learning. I mean, throughout the career of this group, one or two or many of us had throat issues. Because at first, I don't think, you know, I'll speak for myself, but I don't think we really knew. And our music became more complicated, too, and higher and more concentrated. And then having to do a show every night and do all that music, do Birdland every single night, you know. For me, I'm still working on trying to do that song every night, you know, and we try and rest, but that's real hard when you're traveling.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, people go, oh, God, he's so lucky you get to travel and sing for a living. And we go, yeah, but it's hard work.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard work to keep this. So you got to a little bit. You got to baby yourself.
Have you done a lot of vocal training? One thing about singers, they're always going to a lesson. Every singer I know, they're on their way to a lesson. Like a ballet dancer, they're always training, you know? Yeah. Do you still train?
Well, when I was in high school, I was doing like weekends. I was doing like gigs, you know? And before my voice changed, mm-hmm. I never had a problem singing. Nobody ever taught me. I would just sing, and it was effortless. But when my voice changed, my breathing changed. My whole mechanism changed, and I would go out and do a gig, you know, like maybe a 45-minute set, and then I wouldn't be able to talk for 4 days, and my throat was like completely raw. And when I got into college. I studied classical actually when I was in school, and my teacher saw what I was doing, and she said, "You got to give me a year. You have to stop everything else. You got to stop all of your other singing." I said, "But I got gigs." And she said, "No, you have to stop it. You have to
place
this." She said, "If you don't change what you're doing, by the time you're 25, you're not going to have a voice left. You're going to blow it out." And it was really, really hard. I mean, it actually took longer than that, you know. By the time I graduated, it finally kind of clicked in. And what I learned in terms of technique, and it doesn't matter for a singer what you do, whether you sing opera, whether you sing jazz, whether you, you know, pop, whatever it is. Technically, you're still dealing with the same kind of instrument and how it works. And it's, very, very important.
I'm really glad you spent a minute on that because, you know, a lot of, in the NAMM family, there's a lot of pop musicians and there's a lot of rock musicians who come in with this wonderful natural gift. And you hear a lot of really great damage. Potential that's just lost.
Yeah.
And the fact that here you are, 40 years later, you've obviously, that's one of your people to put up on a pedestal who said, you're going to have to stop and learn and listen.
Absolutely.
Stop, listen, and learn to save this, to create your path forward.
The recent big pop singers have lost their voice, like right at the peak of their careers. I don't want to name names, but just singing wrong, or just not even, I don't want to say singing wrong, but just pushing too hard and not having the placement, you know, knowledge of what to do with the voice. Because pop music is like so different than jazz.
Well, and there's so much passion.
You got to blow out every note.
There's so much emotion, you know. Yeah. It's all about, you know, the emotion and the intensity, and then all of a sudden, wait, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
How about your vocal training?
I didn't have any vocal training again, and...
Because you had a contract when you were in high school.
Yeah, I just opened my mouth and sang. Yeah. And, but... When I joined the transfer, I started getting into trouble because I didn't know how to modulate myself. Again, it was like, oh, I have to give 1,000% every show. Mm-hmm. And when we started going on the road a lot, and I was getting hoarse a lot. So in 1980, I started studying. Mm. And I had a wonderful teacher, which we all shared, named Roland Wyatt. And he basically just said, you have to relax. You don't have to give 1,000% every song. You just watch, you know, you could give 60% and it will still be fine. Mm-hmm. And he basically just gave gentle warm-ups, taught me how to breathe, and got the mechanism going. I still study today. I have a wonderful teacher in New York, and I think it's very valuable to have someone look at you while you're singing and correct any imbalances or your alignment. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing I wanted to say is that one of the challenges of the Manhattan Transfer is that we sing all these different styles in the course of one show. Most people or even groups sing one style throughout the show. They're belting, or they're singing ballads, or in the course of one show, we do everything from swing to ballads to bebop to vocalese to rock to, you know, pop, R&B. You know, it's all these different techniques. So
versatility.
It's tricky.
So you lead me into my next question, and the final kind of three-part form here, so right in the middle of the second part, okay? Just so Don't want to wear you out. You've got an evening ahead of you. But how did you find this groove, this Manhattan Transfer groove? And, you know, you said it has multiple genres. You're obviously jumping around. It's this tight, tight, tight harmony with all the augmented core, augmented intervals in it. You said you did this study. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you studied? And I know you lost one of the founding member.
That we
obviously
did.
Was
yes, Tim Hauser.
Very, very much a part of this groove.
Absolutely. Right?
And but you know, how did it? I said yes. We know enough now. We're going to keep going, and we feel it's this. Did it evolve? Was it conscious? Was it deliberate?
It was conscious.
Okay, so
yeah.
All right.
Well, in the very beginning, the idea was to apply closed four-part harmony to contemporary music, as well as reimagining and mining this load of American music that had been neglected, that we thought was fantastic. We thought was witty and musical and rhythmically interesting. You know, all these arrangements from great groups like Bing Crosby and the Rhythm Boys and the Boswell Sisters and the Pied Pipers and the Merrimacks and the Modernaires and the Hi-Los and the Four Freshmen.
Everybody was listening to for all those decades, right?
Yeah, and they were pop music at one point.
Oh, yeah.
And then it kind of stopped. And Tim was really, he was the thrust. In the beginning, he was the thrust behind this. He had this vision of this, you know, and we knew that we didn't want to be a band. You know, we didn't want to play instruments. We wanted to be like a traditional vocal group that's up front and that we would have a band. The first wave, I call it the first wave, when we started, you know, we were very kind of nostalgic. You know, we would wear tuxedos and gowns and do a lot of material that was there. And there was a fad of that music at that time. It was very, very popular. Not only on the East Coast where we were from, but also in Europe when we started to play over there, it was very popular. But our manager at the time, who was also managing Bette Midler, he said, listen, if you keep doing the same thing, this fad is going to go away, and if you stay doing this, you're going to go away with it. And he made us aware that we needed to constantly stay current. We could have the vision, the ideas to do different things, different music, but that we had to move on, you know.
Just sort of David Bowie's ethos also. Mm-hmm. He kind of started around when we started. It was the beginnings of glitter rock and all of that, entertaining again, dressing up. The era of the singer-songwriter, the folky hippie was kind of going away a little bit.
Lots of makeup.
Lots of makeup.
Lots of makeup.
And glitter lips.
And glitter lips.
Oh, yeah. right. So you stayed true to the voice that you knew was what you wanted to do as artists. Then you had this eye to the culture, right? And where it could fit within the market, right? It was just this wonderful.
The thing is that harmonically, it was like taking what we were harmonically and you place it in a different place. So we always had our sound, even if we changed some of the voicings for it, you know, made it more open or something, but we always had that sound. And in the beginning, when we started, we really worked hard on that. We rehearsed every single day. Every day we rehearsed, you know, to really, you know, look at the phrasing, look at our tone, look at the vibratos, basically make our voices one, you know.
Well, this is the art of teaching other people to sing harmony. You can't just hand them the music and say, sing your part. You have to teach them first, simply shape your vowels together, listen. You know, there's an art to the harmony singer. It's consistency. You know, it's not like being in a solo singer at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are words to music teachers' ears. They will love hearing. They're trying to tell their students this every day. You know, the greatest force you have as a singer is your ear, right?
That's right.
Listening.
Yeah. That's right.
It's definitely a different art because, for example, when you look at like Broadway singers, for example, It's really, if you were to have four singers that have been trained kind of with the idea of doing a Broadway show, when they would sing harmony, they wouldn't blend. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be really listening to each other. It's just a different thing.
So you have, what I saw was a massive touring schedule.
Massive?
Mm. Massive.
Really? I better pack now.
You I don't think you've ever unpacked.
No, I always have a suitcase next to the back door.
I mean, to look at that tour and your international reputation and your what obviously is pulling audiences that are pulling on you from everywhere. So this is no like slowing down business here. Mm-mm. Am I right? I mean, so the question is, touring is its own business. Right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's its own in that where what is next sort of creatively? Is there, we have to still be able to find time or what do we want to do if, I really do want to do that wordless version of Eric Satie on the going up in an elevator, going up elevator. I knew we'd get them to sing.
Right? Yeah, that's what we want to do.
Right?
We have a new record out. We have a new CD.
All right, where can we find it?
Well, you can find it in all of your local, internet places of business.
Right.
The
usual.
The usual. But to answer your question, we are working. Okay, you make a record. The record's done. Then you have to learn the song live to do it. Because recording is a completely different animal, as we said before, than actually, performing live. So we're now in the process of relearning the music that we recorded to do live.
And the name of the album is just
The Junction.
The Junction. Yes.
Thank you very much. A lot of wonderful songs. We kind of went full circle on this project. It feels like early transfer, but, we wrote most of it based pretty much exclusively on who we are and what we've done for 45 years. And it just came together beautifully. So, it's a lot of work going out on tour, and it's a lot of work relearning songs that people just assume because we just recorded that we know. You got to go in and sometimes move parts around, do whatever it takes to get it live, mm-hmm. To do it live.
Yeah. So what else is on the wish list, if only... If only we didn't have to do Berlin on Tuesday, what else would we be?
Well, to be realistic, touring is our stream of income.
That's it.
That's how we make our money. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't know if I'd ever want to stop singing for fans out there all over the world. But, there are other ways that we've been exploring, like a show, like a real show where we stop in a city and do a book story, a book show, mm-hmm. maybe. Mm-hmm. Because how we got together is kind of interesting.
It's a story.
It's
a book. Yeah,
it's a fantastic story.
Yeah.
The way the group started.
And the times that you have performed through, 40 years of being really, really well known in an iconic marquee performing group. And what it has taken you and where you have taken the pop scene to. I mean, you have led, you have followed, you participate sometimes, but...
I think the key to the longevity is also balance. To be able to... I say this a lot of times, I feel like a professional juggler, and keeping all the balls up in the air. Because we have to balance. We have other things that we do. And so for our well-being, I remember when we started, like when we first kind of hit and, back in, when we were touring, we were out for 9 months out of the year just living out on the road all the time. Obviously we don't do that anymore. I think that what is invigorating for us is when we walk out on the stage and the relationship between us and the audience, mm-hmm.
Which you've earned, right?
Yes, yes. Our partner Tim used to say, "I get paid to travel. I get to sing for free." I love that, and it's pretty true because the travel part is the work, mm-hmm. And then you go, "Oh, that's why we're doing this." Gal said, you get on stage.
It's also a personal discipline. I don't think people realize how much singing is an athletic event. And the athleticism comes in with the stamina you need to travel. So you have to work on that stamina. You can't just have it. You have to work on it.
You know, we were sponsored a research study that talked about the role of really rigorous singing for older adults. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just the kind where they were sitting around and kind of listening to music and la-da-da-da-da. It was actually by a very serious coach, sitting up straight, singing in tune, learning repertoire, serious, serious performing, And the results of the well-being of these seniors as compared to the people who were playing, doing other things, was just so remarkable. That it has, you know, it's moving its way now into healthcare. It's moving its way into senior citizens.
The benefits of music for Alzheimer's patients is amazing. My father passed away from Alzheimer's disease, but to the very end, he was singing.
It's one of the last things in, you know, in our biology.
It's in a different part of the brain.
To the music. Where it connects all the parts of the brain so it can activate.
But that's absolutely true. My wife is from Yorkshire, England. And up in Yorkshire, they have the original karaoke, but they always have, in the pubs, they always have somebody that's there that plays, and everybody goes to do a sing-song. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to get up and do a song, you know, all right then, all right, you're going to, you know, and it's just, you hear them sing, and it just gives them this spark of life. It absolutely is wonderful. It's great.
And now there's so much music in hospitals, too. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just like roving balladeers going from room to room. I did that a few times, and it's, you know, it lights you up. It does activate a different part of the brain, and it heals.
Right.
It can physically and scientifically heal you inside. It really does.
Well, I think we can say as we end here that the Manhattan Transfer is the soundtrack of our lives. It's a soundtrack of many of our lives.
It's
a sound when I knew I was going to have the chance to interview you. I heard you in my mind before I went to listen to you. I knew that the sound. So thank you for your artistry, for all that you've contributed, and for your important award today. And
thank
we hope
you.
That you'll visit us at NAMM sometime, our NAMM show in Anaheim. Here we are in Nashville. We're in California. Mm-hmm. We'll check your massive touring schedule and see if we can have you there with us sometime.
I love going to the NAMM show.
So thank you so much.
Yeah.
And thank you for joining us for this wonderful edition of Talking at Music Education with the Manhattan Transfer. Thank you for joining us.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. NAMM. That's Mary L. N-A-M-M.